Hear NFL legends, players, coaches, and media members from around the country sharing their insights and stories with us year-round. Here on Thursday night, Tailgate.
And now joining us is former BC Lions wide receiver Marco Iannuzzi. He's our next guest Hall of Fame inductee of the night. Marco is from Calgary, Alberta. He went to college here in the States, like Bob talked about at the top of the show, at Harvard and MIT. Played his college ball at Harvard, where he is still their all-time leader in kickoff return yard average. In fact, he had a 95-yard kickoff return for a touchdown against Brown back in 2010. And that season, he averaged 34.5 yards per return, which set the team record for highest single-season average. He was a first-round draft pick, the number 6 overall selection by the BC Lions in 2011. He helped them go on to win the Grey Cup that season. Played for the Lions from 2011 to 2017. Now, Marco is one of the most philanthropic guys you're going to find anywhere. He does work for the BC Children's Hospital and the Children's Hospice in Vancouver. Plus, he's volunteered as a charity auctioneer, a board member for organizations like Sources BC, Elves for Autism, the MS Society of Canada, Bring Back Hope, and the Whistler Invitational. In 2016, he was the recipient of the Tom Pate Memorial Award, which is given annually to the player who displays outstanding sportsmanship, made a significant contribution to the league and to the community. 2018, he received the Sovereign's Medal of Honor for volunteers from the Governor General of Canada. And if all of that's not enough, he won the title of Canada's Smartest Person on a TV show of the same name, which aired up in Canada on CBC. Marco has been a fantastic part of the show. Joined us all the way back for the first time on September 5th of 2013. Many of his appearances, we were lucky enough to have him on when he was on the BC Lions team bus after a game. He joined me a few weeks ago over on the golf show on Next on the Tee. So it's with a great deal of appreciation and respect that we induct Marco into our Thursday night tailgate guest Hall of Fame tonight. Marco, thank you for all you've done and meant to us over the years. You're fantastic, my friend. How are you?
Welcome, Marco.
Wow, Chris and Bob, thanks, man. Thanks, guys, for having me. Thanks for the intro. And I'll tell you, I'm tickled pink right now as I received the plaque you sent me just yesterday, and I'm holding it here in my hand, and I'm actually going to mount mount it on my wall, and I'll snap a photo and put it up on social media. But it means a lot to me because I can't believe it's been 7 years, 8 years almost. And wow, you guys are it's always fun chatting with you guys. So thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for the great honor of inducting me to the Hall of Fame.
No, we can't thank you, Marco, enough for your generosity over the years. Marco, I want to start out our time tonight talking to you about perseverance. Now, I think you're a shining example of someone who has a dream and you've been willing to work hard for it. Harvard didn't come knocking on your door and you didn't get in the first time you applied there. And if I remember correctly, you didn't get in the second time either, but you kept at it and you've gone on to achieve so many things. For yourself, for your families, and then obviously, you know, the philanthropic things you do for so many charities. Talk about your goals and how you went out and made them, you know, made them a reality.
Well, thanks for pointing out to everyone that I was not smart enough to get in on the first or the second time. I appreciate that. I'll tell you what, you know, when I was a kid growing up, I was in one of my earliest childhood memories. I found my dad, I found this box in our crawl space and had my dad's football jacket in there, right? A leather Letterman jacket. You know, it said provincial champions right on the chest. And it looked just so cool. I brought it upstairs. I said, "Hey, Pop, how do I get one of these?" And he said, "Well, you don't get one of these. You earn one of these." And I was like, "Okay, well, you know, tell me about this. Tell me more." And he started to tell me this story about this St. Francis football program that was, you know, filled with tradition, and every kid that came through, it's a 3-year high school, so 10, 11, 12, every kid that came through the program won at least one provincial championship, and it was an ongoing record for 40 years. And he talked about how, you know, they only cared about the name on the front of your jersey. That's why no one's names was on the back of the jersey. Talked about how you had to wear your helmet all the time because the moment you took your helmet off, you became an individual, and individuals can't win championships. And I'm talking, our locker room was in the gym. So you had to, you know, school ends, you put on all your gear in the gym and you walk through like a 40-yard hallway, down another 40-yard hallway. You're seeing like all of your friends at their lockers still, and you're not allowed to speak to any of them because you're in uniform and you're click, click, clicking on the ground. You finally get outside, you do your hour practice. You know, no matter if you're hurt, whatever, you keep that helmet on. When you're drinking water, you keep that helmet on. Then you do that whole walk back. And so you basically have your helmet on for 3 hours. And, you know, on game day, it was even crazier because we played at a sort of a community set of fields that was about 20 minutes from our high school. And so when we would drive out there, you had to do that whole walk, like I said, right? Take this 20-minute bus ride, still wearing the helmet, get to the field, do your warm-up, play your game, post-game, do your media, and you're doing the media with your helmet on. Get on the bus, go all the way back, and then we used to go to the hill, and we used to run a hill for every point that was scored on. And what we were told was to, when you're wearing that helmet, you're thinking about all the guys that came before you, the 2,000 men that came before you, what they sacrificed to get that jacket, and if you're lucky enough, you'll get this jacket. And so to answer your question directly of where I fostered and grew this desire to never give up is when we finally got there, you know, me and about 13 of my buds who all started playing football together in fifth, sixth grade, and we all had uncles and cousins and brothers who had played in this St. Francis program. They'd all won their jackets. We built it up in our head so much. It was almost like we were trying to build a 10-meter high dive, getting ready to jump on. We get 10th grade, we went undefeated. We get 11th grade, we went undefeated. And the people around us are saying, okay, you guys won twice. No one's ever done that. So don't expect to win a third time. No, it just doesn't happen. So even at the moment where we had achieved so much, we were actually told that we couldn't do any more. And guess what? That third year we went undefeated. So we went three-peat undefeated all 3 years. And what I realized is me and those 13 friends, instead of building a 10-meter high dive, we built a 12-meter high dive and we became the big fish in a big pond. And it really, honestly, truthfully made me believe that anything is possible. So when I applied to Harvard and I didn't get in and people said, there's no way you're going to go to Harvard, Marco. You're a skinny white receiver in Calgary, Alberta. How are you going to go to Harvard University and play football? And well, the next year I didn't get in and people said, see, you're crazy. At that point, I turned down Notre Dame and Boise State, hoping for late admission with Harvard. And everyone said, you're crazy. And then on that third time, along the way, all the people that were telling me, they said I wasn't going to make it. It sounded a lot like the people when we were in high school that said, oh, wait, you're not going to win once, or you're not going to win twice, you're not going to win three times. And we did it. And so that third time when I finally got in, people that had stopped supporting me over those 3 years, they came crawling back and asking for tickets to games. And it was a cool experience to realize that here was my goal. And I accomplished it in high school. Here was my goal. I accomplished it at Harvard. And Harvard, you know, biggest name in the world, in my mind, I said, if I can accomplish these goals, that means truthfully, I can accomplish any single thing in this world that I want.
So, Marco, it sounds like, you know, one of the things, and you know, I'm a big Pittsburgh Steelers fan, and we lost our first game of the season, you know, this past weekend. And one of the things that I didn't want for the Steelers was to have to go into the playoffs carrying that undefeated, mm-hmm. you know, sort of extra baggage of pressure into the postseason. And I was sort of curious if that was, you know, the same for you, but it almost sounds like since people were telling you guys you couldn't do it, there wasn't the pressure of, God, we're undefeated and we've been undefeated now for, you know, 15 games, 20 games, 25 games, 29 games. It didn't seem like to me, based on what you just said, that you carried that pressure. It was almost sort of, you know, I don't know, 90, 180 degrees different because so many more people were telling you couldn't do it that just drove you guys to be able to do it. Was it a different sort of pressure or no pressure at all? It was more of we're going to show you we can.
I think the feeling of the people like not thinking we were going to do it, that was only realized in retrospect because we were machines. And what I mean by that is, you know, you hear all the guys, especially the NHL guys, oh, we got to take it one game at a time, you know, whatever. But I'm telling you, we were machines. We got out to that field and we knew we were all in. Like you got to understand, we put that helmet on, you're not speaking. And this is not like a few of the guys on the team are serious about it. Every single member of the team, 58 guys, high school, right, are not speaking the moment they put that helmet on and they go to practice and you don't say a word and you're thinking and you are locked in. And you do that for a week and you just do that for 1 week. Don't speak for a 3 hour chunk of the day and just be with your own thought and be focused on what you're doing and why you're doing it. And I'll tell you, all those guys on that team, I've never been on a team that was more all in. And I'll say I played on, you know, I've won championships. I won a pro championship, 2 Ivy League championships, junior football championship, high school championship. That team there, if I had to walk through a dark alley, I would want that team with me because we were not going to be stopped. And we walked into every game not thinking about our record. We walked into every game thinking about how we were going to best represent this tradition and how we were going to best represent something that was way bigger than ourselves. And even fast forward at Harvard, we were told to represent our fight song was 10,000 men of Harvard. You're supposed to think of the 10,000 men that came before you. And even at the BC Lions, we were in our 60th year when we won the Grey Cup. We were told to think of the 60 years of tradition that came before us. And then the actual Grey Cup itself, we were in the 99th Grey Cup. So it was always playing for something bigger than ourselves, not thinking of a season of a record. We were thinking of a lifetime of a record. And I think in that sense, it's not a pressure. It's more of a driving desire to really just leave it on the line and put your stamp on a bigger history than any one season.
And Marco, staying on the idea of mentally tough. Now, something that I could never possibly do, you've done, I think, multiple times, and that is take the polar plunge. I was looking back at some of the things that you've done over the course of the last few years, and a couple of years ago, you dressed up like the character Gru from the Despicable Me. You jumped in at the Vancouver Polar Plunge in support of Special Olympics, and it sort of made me think of the scene from Rocky III when Rocky's going to go fight Thunderlips for charity, and Mickey says nobody else would do that much for charity. And Rocky says, you know, Bob Hope would. You're that guy. You're the Bob Hope guy. Talk about taking the polar plunge. What's that like?
You know, it's kind of neat. So we're obviously here on the West Coast, and the water gets pretty chilly in that, you know, December, January time. And I'll put it to you this way. You think of it, it sounds crazy, but this is the way I put it into perspective. I said, okay, when I was playing football, pro, or even actually it was better at Harvard, we had 4 hot tubs in the training room. And actually, 2 of them were cold tubs, and they were, you know, like 10-person cold tubs, 2 of them, and 2 10-person hot tubs. And we used to go back and forth all the time, and it was actually a rejuvenating experience, and it actually, I think it reloaded my central nervous system, helped me out a ton in all of my training camps, so on and so forth. So if I just looked at it as a therapeutic thing, it's great. Okay. But now this is where the cool thing is, because you don't even have to think about any of that. Because I'll tell you what, when I was in training camp in one of my first years, we go up to the interior of BC and we hold training camp in a small town. So to give all the other communities that surround there a chance to come see us, who get to see us during the season, they get to come see us during training camp. And I had this little special athlete come up to me, and he was telling me about how he is joining baseball and how he was joining bowling and how he was joining powerlifting. And the list went on. Like, this kid was doing like 15 different events. And when he talked about each one, he knew every stat and every technique. And it was so inspiring. Like, when I think about it right now, I'm getting goosebumps, because he was just the epitome of purest passion for sport. And so Polar Plunge is to support Special O. So anytime that Polar Plunge, or they could have asked me to jump off the side of the building, which actually they actually scheduled before, but it was windy this one day, but I was supposed to rappel down the side of a building in downtown for Special Olympics too.
Wow.
But I'll tell you, honestly, the cold weather, you don't even think of it, because all I thought about is seeing my guy, Kevin, and thinking of what an inspiration he was to me, and what an inspiration and what he is to all of BC. And I think up to all athletes around the world, to be honest with you. So for me, And actually, I wasn't the only one, right? There's a lot of it. There's about 100 people that show up to do that plunge, and they're all doing it for someone in their life, too. And, you know, I think when you're, again, doing something for a bigger cause, doing something for something bigger than yourself, when you're part of a team of people jumping in the water, you can do anything as a team. And jumping in some real cold water, not a problem at all.
Bob, questions for Marco?
Hey, congratulations, Marco. And I'm always fascinated that I'm able to talk to you about some Ivy League football and everything about the Ivy League. And first, I want to focus on the education itself. You know, I don't know if too many people know, Marco, the stress that's put on these student athletes in the Ivy League. It's not like you can just get by. These guys are in classes and reading about what you had to go through, you know, economics and pre-med, and you did not, you know, take your normal, small man courses, let's put it that way. But it's tough. And I can only imagine it's not easy when you go into Harvard. But did you find it harder than you thought, or do you think you were so well prepared going in that you kind of just got it quickly?
So I'll say that the second time I didn't get in, I had done everything that they kind of told me to do after the first time, which was, you know, improve my SATs. I rewrote some previous courses from high school to bring up my GPA. I rewrote like 10th grade courses in 12th grade to try and bring up my GPA for them. I did all these other things. But what they said to me is, you know what? The second time, while I was doing all those things, I was just playing junior football and I was working a job as a manager of a restaurant, you know, but I wasn't involved in academia on a day-to-day basis, just online courses. So they said to me, we don't think you can hang in with the academic workload that we have. And I said, well, what's that? And they said, we got 4 courses and you're probably going to have to do 1,000 pages of reading a week, 100 pages of writing a week, and then 2 science or math-based problem sets a week. And you're just not built with that capacity, that workload. And I was like, well, first of all, that does sound like a lot. But second of all, let's see if I can actually get going on this. So my third time before I got in there, when I went to Western Reserve Academy and I played, post-grad year, I actually started to get into trying to read a lot more, trying to, push the limit of writing papers instead of 10-page papers, writing like 15 and 20-page papers. And I was like, man, this is tough. Like, there's really the only way you can get all this work done is if you sleep less, because there's actually not enough time in the day. Now, fast forward when I'm at Harvard, to make things more difficult, my wife and I, so we got married at second year Harvard. She's from Calgary, and we had our first child. So we were living for those 2 years off campus in Malden, which is like 4 communities north from Harvard. It's the only place that we could afford. But life was tough. And this is how tough life was. I did not have a day or night. I would, every 10 hours or so, I tried to sleep for 1 hour, wherever I might be. So I knew I wanted to be fresh for morning workout with the team. So I'd always, and also they had air conditioner in the locker room and a nice leather couch. So I'd always make sure around 4 in the morning, I went to the locker room and I'd sleep from about 4 to 5:30 before all the boys would start coming to the locker room. And then I would also plan my next 10 hours later. I'd be in a nice cozy, we had a bunch of little satellite libraries at Harvard, like throughout all the dormitories, there's little cubbies and sort of, like I said, there's satellite, libraries where there's maybe only 2 or 3 people there. So I'd always make sure I had one of those places, to sleep. And it was tough, right? We're raising our first daughter, sleeping 1 hour every 10 hours. And I liken it to, again, being a machine and taking some stuff that I learned from, being a, St. Francis Brown and doing something, for the guys around me and just getting things done, like almost like a SEAL, like it was like a military approach to it. And when I started getting, I was getting good grades the whole time I was there, but when I started achieving like 1 year, 2 year, 3 years success, and you start realizing that it is possible to do all these things so much so that you can actually do more. Like I remember I launched every time I had 3 shoulder surgeries over Harvard. Every time I had a shoulder surgery, I used that downtime to launch a business. And I launched an architectural business, an e-commerce business, a financial business. And so I kept stacking on, because the good thing about being in any school is you know exactly where you're going to be over that 4 years. You know you're going to be, you know, at this school for 4 years, and then real life starts and builds and different types of things. But there's almost a safety net in knowing that that's what's going to happen to you for the next 4 years. And in real life, you don't really know where you're going to be the next year. You might change your job. You might change where you live. You know, there's a number of other factors. So after I graduated from Harvard, I was so sharpened that if I had to go to, you know, I had my RBC business while I was playing, I'd leave practice. The guys would always hoot and holler at me because I'd be wearing a suit every day to practice, and I'd wear a suit out of practice because I'd go to my office, and by about, you know, 3-4 o'clock, I'd get to my other office and I'd work till, you know, 9-10 o'clock. And people say, well, how did you go to practice at 7 in the morning, do all the stuff with the team till 2 o'clock, go to your office from 3 until 10 o'clock? That's crazy. And I said, no, it's not crazy to me because I can sleep for 8 hours in my own bed. When I did this at Harvard, I was only able to sleep 1 hour every 10 hours. So this is easy. And so pushing myself to that limit at Harvard makes me realize truthfully that every other day after that in this other life that I'm living now is a piece of cake when I think back or compare it to the hardship that was Harvard.
And Marco, if I'm not mistaken, I believe you played in 4 Yale-Harvard games. I've seen the last 25, which means I saw you at least twice at the Yale Bowl. And I would think one of the highlight of your life when you were playing at Cambridge, when you ran a kickoff back for a touchdown, that's going to stay with you forever in the game. But, you know, we see a lot of things on TV, Marco, Florida State, Michigan, Ohio State. Unless you're immersed in the Yale-Harvard rivalry, I don't know if people can ever I still get goosebumps when I walk in the Yale Bowl when it's not a Yale-Harvard game. But that game's a little different than every game. But is there any rivalry anywhere like that?
You know, it's special, man. And, I played in the 127th plane of it, longer than the Michigan State. Like, it's entrenched in tradition. And when you see, you know, highlights in black and white, like way, way back, and you know, it's like flickering because it's so old, you're like, wow, like this has been going on for so long. I'll tell you, when I, in my senior season, I shattered my collarbone for the second time. It was my third shoulder surgery. We had to remove the old plate and 8 screws and put in a new plate and 8 screws. And that happened in game 3. And the doctor said it's a 10-week recovery before you can start, like 8 to 10 weeks before you can start lifting weights and starting to feel like yourself. Harvard-Yale game was 6 weeks away. And I said, you know, doc, and I, unfortunately, I knew my surgeon by first names. I said, hey, Mark, listen, man, I got 64 friends and family coming from Calgary. They've already booked this, you know, months ago. You know, I got my grandparents coming. I got my old high school buddies. I said, we got to find a way to make this work. And he's like, okay, tell you what, like, we got to get you on the field by week 5. Otherwise, if you don't practice, Coach Murphy was tough. If you didn't practice the entire week before the game, he didn't care if you were all world, you were not playing in that game. So I wasn't even supposed to start running until 8 to 10 weeks. But at week 5, I showed up to practice fully geared up, and I ran all the routes with the guys. It was tough, but I'll tell you what, we got into that game, and I'll put it this way: the scar had basically barely healed at this point. And if I would have got hit, I would have been in some serious trouble. Like, right, it would have been very painful. Okay, and I was at halftime. I didn't play the first half early, and at halftime, I walked up to Coach Murphy, and I just looked at him in the eyes. And this is a man that over those 3 years of me getting into Harvard, he was always in my corner, always had my back. He, you know, like I said, when my wife and I had our child, he was supporting it. Like, you got to see, we had a long relationship. And I just looked him in the eyes, and he knew exactly what I was saying. It was basically, I'm ready. Like, let's go, put me in for kick return, because I wasn't scheduled to be the kick returner. Obviously, you're going to get blown up. Shoulder's going to come flying out. So he said, "Okay, you got it." And I just reposted it there a couple of weeks ago. It's on my social media. But that thing came down to me, and I knew before I caught. I said, "I'm not getting tackled by a single person on this field." And I got that ball. And as I was running, I kid you not, the flashes in my head of after I cut off to the left side and I had just me in the goal line for those last 30 yards, I was literally flashing in my head, like the flickering black and white footage that I'd seen of the history games that came before me. And to think that I was going to be, 40 years from now, they're going to look at our grainy footage of our 4K right now. And they're going to say, man, that guy was real. And it was so cool because if you look at the video I posted on social media, I got the Nesson cut, but the better cut is the one from the pocket phone from one of my uncles. And you hear all of my 64 friends and family yelling. They jumped over the edge of the field after that game. They literally picked me up on their shoulders. It was nothing short of a Rudy Rudinger in the movie getting lifted and carried off the field. And it was like, it's great. I get goosebumps. And as I tell you right now, like it, to be a part of something so history, man, it was special. Man, it was special.
It's a fantastic story. And very inspirational, Marco, just like everything that you do. I want to talk to you about the Grey Cup with the BC Lions, because there's another thing that I imagine, early on through the season was something else people were telling you guys couldn't do. You guys didn't start that season looking like a Grey Cup championship team, but you turned it around and it all ended up in another sort of storybook ending. Tell the story about that.
So I was the first round draft pick for the Lions, and I've been interviewed a whole bunch during camp and this and that, but none of them were live interviews. They were all taped, and then they'd run them later, right? And so the first time our TSN, which is the equivalent of ESPN down there, TSN guy, I'm doing a live interview, right? And we're 0-5, okay? And the guy goes to me, he goes, "Hey Marco, your hometown Calgary passed you up in the draft. I was sixth overall pick in the first round, but my hometown Calgary had the fifth pick and they didn't take me." And so he goes, "You were passed up in the draft by your hometown. You're playing, you now are the worst team the BC Lions has seen in 60 years. Not many people in this province think you guys are worth a cent. How does it feel to be a BC Lion?" And I'm on live TV. I'm like, it was a real rough interview, let's just say the least. Okay. Now flash forward. We went on a tear. We ended up winning out every single game for the rest of the season. And, we were hosting the Grey Cup, believe it or not. It was a storybook. We were hosting Grey Cup. We went on this tear 0-5 to now, complete win out. And we're in the Grey Cup. We win the Grey Cup. The confetti is falling on our head. And that same TSN reporter comes up to me and he says, "Hey, this whole province has supported you guys and believed in you guys since day one. How does it feel to be a Grey Cup champion?" And I'll tell you, that is not the case. But I will say this, okay? So a lot of teams, when they get into some turmoil, right? We lost 5 games. All of a sudden, trades start happening. New guys start getting brought in. Our coach didn't even bring in new practice roster guys. He said, he closed the door, and he said, "Look at each other right now, because these are the guys we're going to win the Grey Cup with. We're not bringing anybody in. We're not putting anybody out. This group here is going to turn this team around and do something that is going to make history." And our president came in and he said, "Boys, when we win the Grey Cup, I'm going to get engraved on the inside of your Grey Cup rings, 'Believe, Achieve, and Make History.'" And I kid you not, that was all said after 5 games of losing. And we flipped that switch, man, and we believed, we achieved, and made history. And I'll tell you, if I wear my ring for too long at an event and I pull it off, I can see 'Believe, Achieve, Make History' is embedded in my finger. And I'll tell you, that was another special, special team that believed in each other and was willing to, again, go down a dark alley with each other and fight for each other, because everyone was all in.
Bob, one more for Marco.
Yeah, Marco, and we've always are inspired by what you've done off the field, your generosity, et cetera. I'm just wondering if you have a chance on a regular basis to talk to kids, because I think you would be the ideal person to talk to people about the importance of education and sports and the fact that you played professionally 99% of the people that you come across aren't going to be able to do that. Do you get a chance to talk to kids, Marco, and what do you tell them about the importance of the balance of education in sports?
Yeah, so my first, let me boil it back to this. When I was a kid growing up in Calgary, I'd go right down to the edge, you know, where the players walk by, that edge of the stadium there to go into the locker room. And I'd hang over the edge, nearly breaking my ribs, just trying to hang, just please, someone give me a high five. Someone give me a high five. And, you know, I got like just a little fingertip high five by, one guy and just a journeyman player. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is the most special day of my life. And then another guy gave me a high five and I'm like, oh my gosh, like, and those moments there were just so cool. So I said to myself, when I play pro, I was obviously a kick and punt returner. So I'd go out early, you know, the crazy kickers. They got their weird things that their pregame rituals, right? This guy's got to go out 3 hours and 16 minutes before because of 3:16 and I got to be out there with him. So I'm catching kicks and then now he's done and the team warm up is not until for another like hour and a half, right? And so instead of going inside the locker room, I'd spend all that hour and a half, going, and we would always have lots of kids come on our sideline pregame, you know, Special Olympics would come on our sideline then. But lots of schools and youth programs, and I'd go and I'd give every single person, I'd give a high five. I'd take as many of those kids as I could onto center field. The security guards knew me. You weren't allowed to do it, but the ones that had worked there long enough, they'd let me do it. And I'd bring the kids right onto center field and I'd tell them to look around. You know, this is a special moment. And I thought if even one out of 100 of these kids remembered it the same way that I remembered getting that high five, I mean, it was life changing for me. And so I did that every single game as a pro. And I'll tell you, my first off season as a pro, I joined, this program where we went out and we spoke to 75 elementary schools. And at that time we actually focused on talking to the kids about, environmental sustainability and having impact in your community from a sustainability standpoint, but having impact in your community as in giving back and being a leader. And it was, a real important time for me because, like I said, if I'm talking to 200, 300 elementary kids, if even one of those kids remembers it, I'll tell you, when I was in second grade, a guy by the name of Greg Freres came in to our school, and he had just won the Grey Cup for Calgary, and I don't remember what he said that day, but I remember how I felt. And I don't remember, like, anything else but that day, but this moment where he held the cup up in front of us, and it's etched in my mind. I can see it right now in my head of Greg Freres holding this Grey Cup above his head. And it was an image that I carried with me my entire life. And whenever I could, like, I grew up with some bad kids, in seventh, eighth, and ninth grade, making some bad decisions. And I remember saying to myself, hey, do I go right or go left? And some of them was like, hey, do I hold up this corner store with this group? Or if I want to hold a Grey Cup above my head, I better go the other direction. Do I go to this party where I know these guys are bringing knives? Or if I want to hold a Grey Cup, I better go the other direction. That kid, you know, he probably kept me out of jail or saved my life on three or four occasions. Now get this. When I won the Grey Cup, I brought it out to as many, kids and programs and local, football programs. So I bring it to this one down here. Now I'm in BC, right? Keep in mind, I grew up in Calgary. Okay. And I bring it to this little program of these young youth kids. And I start telling them this same story I just told you. And they said, what was the name of the guy? And I said, oh, don't worry about it. You wouldn't remember. They said, what was the name? I said, well, the guy's name was Greg Freres. And all the kids' jaws drop and all the kids look back. Their assistant coach was Greg Freres. And I'm getting goosebumps again as I'm telling you this, but a guy that I had not seen in 22 years impacted my life so greatly just by inspiring me to be the best person I could be. And for me to come full circle and hold the Grey Cup up in front of him, I'm almost in tears right now as I tell you it, but the power of inspiration, and to answer your question directly, I'm very proud to have spoke to coming up on 100,000 people in various, I would say about at least, you know, half of those are youth kids. And I just love sharing stories with them and just making them realize that the people around you are doing special things. You can learn from them, and then you yourself can do special things and inspire people around you.
Marco, one more before we let you go. Talk about what you're doing now with the Beautiful Game Group.
Yeah, so we're doing a few things. I mean, everything that I get involved with now, I do a lot of private equity deals. It has to have societal impact. It has to be positive for the grassroots level around whatever project we're doing, to really affect positively the people in those areas. So, with this group we're doing, we've actually just kind of made a little bit of a name change and sort of changed our group a bit, but it's still the same concept. We're putting together an investment fund and we're going out and we're buying, many, soccer teams, actually worldwide soccer teams, pro level. And the cool thing about it is we're running these teams, not like we're running them like, the way I believe every pro team should be ran, a community run organization. And what I mean by that is soccer is big, obviously, into feeding the players right up from, you know, when they're 6 years old all the way up, and they funnel them into the pro level. So, but not all of them make it pro. So what we're doing with all these teams is we're going in and we're making sure that all their academy programs are not only just trying to build the best athletes, but trying to build the best humans. And then then additionally, obviously, we're putting up these youth programs on the same platforms that the pros get, as far as stadium use and as far as really trying to get them to feel that they're just as big a part of their community as the pro team is. And then, of course, obviously making sure that all of our athletes on our team are programmed to be given back in the community on an actual, genuine, and consistent level. And so there's a massive impact through there. And it's pretty cool to think that, you know, especially soccer, if you can imagine, the communities that soccer teams in are, they're equivalent to, you know, Green Bay fans, right? Every soccer team has that kind of fan base. And to realize that you're having that impact and these people are putting their hard money to come see your game, after their whatever we, you know, difficult week at work or whatever it is, you really have the power to inspire and bring positivity to communities. And that's what we're trying to do.
Marco, before we let you go, let our listeners know, how can they stay up to date with all the great things that you're doing and follow you, whether it's online or it's over social media?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's the easiest way to find me online. Just Google Marco BC Lions, and love to have you on Instagram. You know, I do post a little bit of my kids recently, because they're just the cutest things in the world, and it's so amazing to see them grow up. But I really like to just open the door to my life on, you know, Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and this and that. It's very easy to find Marco BC Lions, and I enjoy seeing what people are up to because I feed off of the positivity that others are bringing. And I really think it's you really get when you give, and just seeing what other people are up to, I think it's a real special thing. And I think social media does a great job of allowing people to connect with each other for causes, connect with each other on a positivity basis, connect with each other on a mental health basis. I think it's doing a great job, especially during these times of COVID.
Well, Marco, we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your schedule to be a part of this show and now being a member of our guest Hall of Fame. You know, you've done so much for this show. I was very grateful to have you over on the golf side earlier this year as well. You mean a great deal to us. It's always great getting to spend some time with you. Congratulations, and thank you for being a wonderful part of our guest Hall of Fame.
You guys, Chris, Bob, you guys are honestly just, I really, from the bottom of my heart, I appreciate every time I spend with you guys, and I can't believe another 45 minutes goes by that fast. But you guys are awesome. And I'll say that you've actually even challenged me, Chris. So when I was on the golf show, I was a little embarrassed, actually, having to say that my handicap was 18 at the time. And so for the last 3 months, I've been ripping at it, and I've actually got my handicap down to 13. And to be truth be told, two more rounds, and I think it's going to be in single digits in no time here. So I appreciate you pushing me to be
wow.
a better person as well.
Great.
Wow. Good for you. Yeah, note to self, I need two strokes aside from Marco now. So, all right. No problem. Marco, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you and your lovely family. We look forward to catching up with you again soon, my friend.
Thanks again, Marco.
Chris, Bob, you guys are the best. Thank you. Cheers.
Stay safe, my friend. See you, Marco. That's the great Marco Iannuzzi, Bob. It's amazing the things that Marco has achieved and continues to do out there. I mean, for crying out loud, he was a wonderful football player, as he talked to us about time at Harvard. And oh, by the way, for those folks that don't also know, Marco not only attended Harvard, he was cross-enrolled at MIT at the same time. So you want to talk about a guy that valued education. and worked his tail off, not only on the football field, but also in the classroom. Harvard and MIT, Bob. Amazing. And what a wonderful human being in the way he gives back in so many ways. Certainly deserved that medal that he won.
Yes, Chris, every time we speak with him, I mean, after he hangs up, it's almost like, my goodness, we could have kept going with him and you would feel better about the world, because knowing that there's somebody like him doing the things he does and his attitude and his positivity and, he was a great athlete on top of everything. But you saw right from the beginning, Chris, that it was far beyond athletics for him, and he knew that from a very young age. And just the way he's led his life and how he's so kind to us. And again, he's well deserving of this honor. And again, you feel the same way I do, and that we can't wait till we talk to him again.
Absolutely. Sovereign's Medal of Honor for volunteers from the Governor General of Canada. And then one of my favorite things, Bob, about Marco from the videos you see, and as I said in his intro, Canada's smartest person on a TV show of that same name. Yeah, Marco won that. And I love watching the video, because when he won it, he dropped the people's elbow on the buzzer to win it. And a lot of fun. The guy's obviously very talented, very smart, and just a wonderful human being. And he's raising his kids the same way. So kudos to him. Marco really is the complete package. Great guy, great father, great philanthropist, and just as smart as they come. So We certainly look forward to the next time we have an opportunity, Chris, to spend more time with him.
My head is still spinning thinking about his schedule at Harvard. How about you?
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, my goodness.
Insane.
So, insane. Yeah. And, you know, again, a kudos to his perseverance. Yeah, he's a guy that seems like throughout his life, whether it was in high school, college, you know, getting into the pros with the Lions and then beyond that, people told him no a bunch, that he couldn't do it, and he proved them wrong every single time. So, and to his point, you know, he was just on the golf show not all that long ago, you know, probably a couple of months ago. So to go from an 18 to a single handicap in that span of time is unheard of. I mean, I say often on the golf show, it took me 10 years to go from awful to terrible. And here Marco is going from being, you know, pretty good to very good in a short period of time. So just another example of his work ethic and his, you know, belief in his passion. So kudos to Marco. Look forward to catching up with him again soon.